So our topic is science and faith going deeper, and the going deeper kind of has a backstory. Almost 10 years ago, not quite, but almost, we did what I would call my first stab at the topic of science and faith, did a lot of reading background, and then tried to do a series on that. The series was less than half the length of this one because there was a lot fewer topics. Several things have led recently to my desire to kind of take another run at this and another stab at it. One is kind of an obvious one, and that is most of the people who are in Kerygma today were not here 9 years ago or so when we first did the original series. And several of you asked, knowing that we did that, could we do it again because you would like to be a part of that? So that was one of the reasons. Another reason is that I knew there were a lot of topics that we left off the table. We simply did not cover them in the original series, and one of the reasons being I did not feel kind of adequately prepared to do that. The most glaring omission was the role that math plays in science. Those of you with a science background know that science has two methodologies. One is empirical. That's what we really tried to cover last time. It involves experimentation. It involves observables via the senses and primary methodology of science. That's called the scientific method. The other is that science also deals with the fundamental laws that lie behind the universe. And the belief is that these laws can be accessed through something known as pure mathematics. This approach to science is based on the premise that the universe or God literally speaks through math. If you want to do some reading, this you see over here on the right-hand side, the book, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, How Modern Math Reveals Nature's Deepest Secrets. I would recommend that. Very readable, very easy, very clear. You don't have to have a math background, and so it can really kind of bring you up to speed. And when I do that session here in a few weeks, I'll be drawing heavily on that book. The pure math approach is not empirical. It is not experimental. It deals strictly with what are known as operators of the mind. Pure math and empirical science, the two different approaches, both have proven to be valuable tools in understanding the very nature of the universe. And again, we simply did not cover that at all in the earlier explorations. So one of the things I'll be doing is doing a presentation on that, as well as weaving some of this into some other presentations. We also did not cover the science of geology and the dating of the earth, known as fossils. You have probably heard that there's some people who believe that the world was created 4004 BC. Turns out that the story behind that is actually a fascinating story. That is not a religious date. That is actually a date that came out of science. And so the story behind that and how that evolved, and then all the way to things like dating things, you know, like radiocarbon dating, but also just radio dating, using things to date. For example, we've recently discovered a meteorite that is older than our solar system. And I'll show you a picture of that in a few weeks when we get to it. And then there's the whole idea of continental drift, plate tectonics and stuff like that. So the whole realm of geology and how geology became a science and fossils and a concept called deep time. That's the time that goes deeper than we used to think. Another gap in the original series is in the area of the more recent developments in science, and this is where I spend a lot of time reading. We dealt earlier with Albert Einstein early in the 20th century, the theories of relativity, the general theory and the specific theory earlier, and then quantum mechanics. But basically, we kind of left physics, except for just a couple of hints, where it was in the 1920s, which is with the advent of all this. As you might imagine, a lot has happened in the last 100 years, including, for example, the development of what is now called the standard model of physics. It is now pretty much considered to be complete. And we also have the ongoing research into what Einstein referred to. He was looking for the kind of a theory of everything. And this goes under the title of quantum gravity. Gravity would be relativity, the science of the large. Quantum is the science of the small. The two sciences both work, they're both elegant, and they do not that they contradict each other. So for the last 100 years, people have been working, trying to come up with an understanding of the large and the small under one general theory. And so that goes under quantum gravity. And so we'll be talking about that. A third reason for kind of wanting to pick up science and faith again is that we did not deal with how changes in our understanding of our faith and the expression of our faith have contributed to the divide. We pretty much hit the science side heavy, but we didn't really deal with, I've dealt with it in some other classes, so I thought we'd kind of bring in this information. You know, how did we get the idea, for example, that the scripture is about data, that it's about literal historical types of things, and how did that then become in conflict? So we need to dip into that and deal with that side of it as well. This is going to include the rise of biblical literalism and approaching the Bible as a source of historical facts and its data. Finally, there is the phenomenon that we're living through right now. It is the growing divide between science and faith today. This is a huge story out there if you're following it. So today we're going to begin by setting the stage with a paradox. On the one hand, they're going to have a one hand and the other hand. On the one hand, we live in the age of scientific wonders. I mean, if you're going to get sick, today's the time to live. Just taking one element of science, the Hubble telescope, I want us to think about this for just a minute and just think about a couple of things. Here is a mind-blowing fact. In the 30 years since Hubble launched, we have learned more about the universe than all previous human history combined. That is not hyperbole. That is a documented fact. We are now about to launch the James Webb Telescope, which will be a quantum leap forward, both in terms of the size of the information it can gather, it's many, many times larger, and the other is the wavelengths. The Hubble telescope was able to get light, you know, at a spectrum of wavelengths, not just visible light, but beyond that. The James Webb Telescope is going to extend that both directions, into the red and into the blue or violet in great. So we'll be able to find things that we've not found. We have confirmed, for example, in the science that we have today, the existence of black holes. You may know that just a couple of months ago, we photographed a black hole for the first time. Guess what? It was not black, but that's a whole different story. We have confirm the existence of dark matter. We have confirmed the existence of dark energy. Now, these were hypotheticals. They've now been confirmed. Hubble, by itself, has allowed us to peer back into time to the edge of the universe. This is a deep field image. This is a little section of the sky that was absolutely total black. There was nothing there, they thought. And with Hubble, they could peer into it. And guess what you see? Pretty much every dot that you see is a galaxy, even the ones that appear to be just dots. The distance is so great that no single star could show up. So every single one of these is a galaxy. It also enables us to peer back in time. We are now able to, you know, with the universe being 14 point something billion years old, we can peer back in time now to within a couple of million years of the Big Bang. And with the James Webb Telescope, they think they can get that down to maybe a few hundred thousand years, back to when visible light first appears. We've literally been able to date the universe at 14 point something billion years old. And then if you follow Hubble, there are the photographs. You're looking at a gaseous nebula that is several light years across. These are called the pillars of creation. And these are nurseries for stars, where gases, hydrogen, helium, other gases are condensing with gravity and beginning to form stars. It's one of the great photographs. Currently, we have sent probes to all of the planets in the solar system. If you look at the picture on the right, the dot at the bottom is the planet Earth. That is viewed from Saturn, viewed through the rings. This was taken by one of our probes that was there. Truly remarkable. We have visited numerous minor planets, comets, and asteroids. Here is a few of the ones that we've been to and got close to and photographed. Four probes have left the solar system, crossed the heliosphere, and have entered interstellar space. Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, Voyager 1, and Voyager 2. You hear more about the Voyagers because they're still broadcasting. They're still giving us information. Pioneer 10 and 11 have not. Their energy sources gave out. That is just one area of scientific discovery, astronomy. You're looking at a picture, by the way, of Pluto and its moon. Now, this does not include the work done with a Large Hadron Collider at the CERN laboratory in Geneva, looking at a picture of part of it there, where we are unlocking the secrets of the universe at the quantum level, at the small scale, the subatomic scale. This is where, fairly recently, the Higgs boson, called the God particle, was discovered, which is the particle that displays mass and therefore could account for the mass in the universe. It was hypothetical. For a long time, they searched for it. It was the last piece of the puzzle that needed to fall into place. It was found. That piece of work led to the completion and the verification of what is called the standard model of particle physics: quarks, leptons, bosons, and the Higgs boson. Here's a little chart of the different types it gets into. These elementary particles make up the universe and their interactions. Again, does not include revolutionary advances in medicine and molecular biology, advances that we rely on to save us from the current pandemic. You know, God bless the scientists working on this, and all across the globe, cutting edge scientific technologies being used to try to find a cure. We live in the golden age of scientific discovery. There has never in human history been anything remotely like the time we're living in. And our lives have been enriched by the benefits of scientific discovery and the technology that is given to us. You know, your phone, your computer, your car, you name it, we're surrounded by the benefits of this technology. On the other hand, look at the picture. We also live in an age of increasing skepticism about science. This is a huge story right now. The skepticism about science is at an all-time high, and it's on the rise. It's not going away, it's increasing. Cover story of National Geographic not too long ago gave us some sort of frightening statistics. Here are some of the ones that I find sobering. Less than half of Americans today believe that global warming is real and that climate change is real. Most Americans are climate deniers. One third of Americans today believe that humans have existed in their present form since time began. There is no human evolution. We did not come from other forms of life through time. We came in a la the Genesis story. Today, people commonly believe that the moon landing was faked, that evolution is, quote, just a theory, that vaccinations cause autism. One look at the vaccinations for a second. 1 in 12 children in America today have not been vaccinated. Over 100,000 children have not been vaccinated against any of the 14 diseases for which shots are recommended. This has resulted in numerous outbreaks of diseases that we thought we had conquered and we would no longer have to deal with. These are diseases that are currently on the rise because we are not vaccinating. Whooping cough, measles, mumps, polio, rubella, German measles, scarlet fever, diphtheria, cholera, bubonic plague, and tuberculosis. I wish this was not true, but this is the world we live in. All of these are on the rise because parents and others do not trust in vaccines. They do not trust the science behind them. Climate change has been declared by many a myth. Genetically modified food is evil. People don't even understand what that actually is. They think it's something that's added to food. It's not. But it's said to be evil. We're told that the truth is not the truth, that there are alternative facts. These are from the political realm. In Texas, we debate whether our children should be taught evolution or creation in their textbooks. And most recently, in the midst of the worst pandemic in modern times in a century, many deny or denigrate the science around COVID-19 virus. The results have been catastrophic, with a loss of countless lives. Now, in each of these cases, there is a pattern. What we are seeing is a fundamental distrust of science. In America, this distrust is often linked to religious beliefs. So we have this idea out there. For many people in the United States today, there is a perception that science and faith are somehow incompatible, that they are locked in a fundamental conflict with each other, that we have to choose science or faith, science or religion, one or the other. This belief comes to us both from some within the religious community as well as from some within the science community. This is not one-sided. There are elements in both community that are feeding what is called the war metaphor, the conflict metaphor, that there's a basic incompatibility here. From the science side, we have those who have famously ridiculed the role of religion and faith in the world. Earlier, this view was exemplified by Carl Sagan, the creator of the Cosmos series, the original Cosmos series, not the new one, and of course, Stephen Hawking, two very famous atheists. More recently, Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists have stepped in the last 10 or 12 years or so. And with them, we encounter a much more militant form of the critique of religion. People who are asserting, as Dawkins does, that all religion is by definition irrational. It's fantasy. It's make-believe. That God is a pernicious illusion or a delusion. Not an innocent thing, but a dangerous illusion, something that does us harm. That religion is the great evil at war with science, at war with rational thought, and something that must be defeated by those who advocate science, reason, and the forward progress of the human race. From the religious side, there are many who see science as an enemy of faith, one that also, again, must be defeated. So again, that warfare kind of image. Science is seen as a threat to our core values, the values of our faith, or even seen as a threat to the foundations of the faith itself. Both sides, we have seen go into combat mode, seeing science and faith, science and religion at war with one another. The most visible flashpoints, at least in terms of the news, have usually been around the issue of creation and evolution, going back from the famous Scopes trial of 1925 all the way up to today when we're still arguing about school textbooks. So even nearly a century after the Scopes trial, evolution is still a flashpoint. Just a personal observation here. I worked with teenagers in our church for almost 30 years. It was truly a blessing. But one of the things that I was able to do is the sixth graders kind of came through in confirmation, was to get a feel for where they were in their thinking. One of the things I realized is that every single year, a significant number of children were struggling with the issue in science and faith, genuinely believing that what they're taught in school in terms of science and what they were taught at home in terms of faith were at odds with each other. So schools on the one hand, parents on the other, but they would come in and see a conflict between science and faith, believing that as faith was taught to them and as science was taught to them, they simply were incompatible. All this raises fundamental questions. Are science and faith really at odds with each other? I'll tell you right up front, I do not think so. I think that's a manufactured conflict that we'll deal with later. But the thing I want to look at is, how did we get here? How did we get to the place that we're at today, where there is this perception that's out there? you know, the irony here is that throughout most of Christian history, science and faith were never viewed as being in conflict. That's a very recent kind of thing. Throughout most of our history, science and faith have been viewed as two distinct but complementary areas of human knowledge. Beginning in the 1600s, though, when our understanding of the world began to change, something significant happened. And we'll talk about that in more detail later. But science began to embrace new ways of viewing the world, and elements of the faith did not embrace the new science. So there began to be kind of a disconnect there. It's not that the faith did not embrace science, it continued to embrace an older version of the science. And so there was a growing disconnect. This created tension and conflict between the old science, called the Ptolemaic science, that had existed for 2,000 years, and the new science of Newton and others, Galileo and others, that was just beginning to emerge. Christians have reacted to this perceived tension between science and faith in a wide variety of ways. Some have resorted to an idea that's called God in the gaps, ceding to science that science, what science can know and explain, which basically to say is, okay, science is the realm of the external world, you know, nature, the world of nature. Faith, on the other hand, is the faith that science cannot explain, the gaps in our scientific knowledge. So things like the existence of the universe, the science cannot tell us why the universe exists. The emergence of life, science cannot tell us about that. The Cambrian explosion, when life just exploded seemingly overnight in ways, that's one of those kind of gaps. Consciousness. These are things that science has not been able to explain. Now, trying to find God in the gaps has been critiqued from within the religious community. I want to give you one by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's been dead for a long time, but he's a very highly respected person, and he has a very eloquent critique of God in the gaps. This is what he had to say. This was gathered from his letters and papers after he was executed by the Nazis. It is wrong to use God as a stopgap for the incompleteness of our knowledge. If, in fact, the frontiers of knowledge are being pushed further and further back, as they are, it's bound to be the case, then God is being pushed back with them. So if God is used to explain the unexplained, the more we explain, the less room there is for God, and is therefore continually in retreat. We are to find God in what we know, not in what we don't know. Now, one form of God in the gaps is to explain that science can explain the outer world, the world of nature, but reserving for faith the interior world of feeling, of emotion, and experience. This was the kind of thing going on during the life of John Wesley in that time period. You know, that faith is about the soul, it's about the heart, it's about experience. Now, some, feeling that they had to choose between faith and the scientific worldview, have taken the anti-scientific, anti-modern world approach. You know, the Amish would be an extreme version, but basically they simply just bowed out, said they don't want to deal with it. The science and the technology, they're just not going to handle it. So either by being openly hostile to science and the modern worldview, or simply taking the attempt to relate to it, some people have taken that viewpoint. Fundamentalism in the early 20th century, the first wave of fundamentalism, took this approach too. They basically just simply bowed out. Others who feel that they had to choose between faith and the modern worldview have gone in the exact opposite direction, letting science and reason dictate what is true and what is to be believed, period. So if it can't be scientifically documented, if it's not reasonable, then we simply chunk it. In doing that, some within the faith have abandoned core aspects of the faith because they believe they're untenable in the modern world of science. Others seek scientific proof, this is more from the fundamentalist or the conservative side, for the things that we believe. They're looking for empirical evidence that would undergird the faith. You might call it Christian fossils, For example, if we could just find Noah's Ark, if we could just date the Shrouded Turin, of course, behind this quest is a tacit belief that I think needs to be challenged, that empirical truth is all that really counts. Now, it's in this setting, I want to introduce us to just a little brief deal here about our United Methodist tradition, because I think our United Methodist tradition can speak to us as we set the stage for this journey together. We are part of a tradition that has historically embraced science, embraced reason, and have seen them as being compatible with the faith, not contradictory. Not in conflict with the faith, but as complementary. So faith and science, each valuable forms of human knowledge, each bringing to the table something the other does not. Science can even be helpful to our faith. So this is what paragraph 104 in our Book of Discipline says right now. Since all truth is from God, that may be the most radical statement in the Bible, in the Book of Discipline. All truth is from God. Doesn't make any difference where it comes from. If it's true, it's true. And if it's true, it is of God. Since all truth is from God, efforts to discern the connection between revelation and reason, faith and science, grace and nature are useful. They're useful endeavors, not just for understanding science, but in developing credible and communicable doctrine. The science can help us understand and refine our understanding of our own faith. We seek, therefore, nothing less as United Methodists than a total view of reality that is decisively informed by the promises and imperatives of the Christian Gospels. Total view of reality being science, imperatives of the gospel being faith. We recognize science as a legitimate interpretation of God's natural world. No ifs, no ands, no buts, no qualifications. We embrace it. We affirm the validity of the claims of science in describing the natural world. By our quest for reasoned understanding of the Christian faith, we seek to grasp, to express, and to live out the gospel in a way that will commend itself to thoughtful persons who are seeking to know and to follow God's ways. Science and theology are complementary rather than mutually incompatible. We therefore encourage dialogue between the science and theological communities. And you actually can argue that for the next 18 weeks, we're doing what this slide invites us to. We're going to be involved in a dialogue between science and faith historically and currently. We seek the kind of participation that will enable humanity to sustain life on earth and by God's grace increase the quality of our common lives together. I don't know about you, but that makes me extremely proud to be United Methodist. Now, this view not only reflects our Methodist tradition and John Wesley, as well as the current doctrinal standards of our church, it also reflects the view of the great scientific minds, Galileo and Einstein. I just want to just throw out some quotes, just so you can get a feel. These are statements that are totally compatible with the Methodistic tradition. Here's Galileo. Mathematics is the language in which God wrote the universe. We think of Galileo as being an empiricist, you know, with the telescope and stuff. He fundamentally was a mathematician. And he's one of those people who really understood the role math plays. We're going to find the same thing with Newton. We're going to find the same thing with Maxwell in the 19th century. We just roll it. He affirms this. Galileo says this: the Holy Scripture and nature derive equally from the one, from the Godhead, the same God. The former, as the dictation of the Holy Spirit, that's Scripture. The latter, science, as the most obedient execution of God's orders. So God can speak through both. Galileo said this: I do not think it is necessary to believe that the same God who has given us our senses, our reason and our intelligence would wish us to abandon their use, giving us by some other means the information that we could gain through them. In other words, there's nothing in science, there's nothing you could conceivably learn in science that would ever threaten your faith, because it's a different type of knowledge. It's also, again, held by other scientists. I thought six quotes by Einstein here. Now, let's be honest. Einstein was not a big advocate of organized religion, but he was a very devoted believer in God. So here's some things. The more I study science, the more I believe in God. When the answer is simple, God is speaking. I believe in the God who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists. I want to know how God created this world. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. This is my favorite. There are fanatical atheists whose intolerance is the same as that as the religious fanatics, and it springs from the same source. They are creatures who can't hear the music of the spheres. And then this one. There are people who say there is no God, but what makes me really angry is that they quote me to support for such views. People of science historically have been people of faith. Not all, but many of the greats. This series that we're going to launch into is predicated on the belief found in the discipline. You might say this is the single organizing principle behind everything we're going to do. Science and faith are complementary, not contradictory. So we're going to be dealing a lot with faith. We're going to be dealing a lot with science. We're going to deal a lot with this idea that there's conflict, and then walk from there. Now, a belief held by most people of faith and people of sciences across the century, the idea of complementary, not contradictory, is held. By the way, that is held by a lot of people in the science community, and of course, a lot of people in the faith community. So what are we going to be doing in this series? I told you earlier, I'm going to kind of just lay out what we're going to do the next 17 weeks, and you can decide if this is something that you want to be involved in. One of the beauties of our model in Kerygma is that we do not have to rush. We can take the time. This is a rich and a complex topic, and it needs to be treated as touched. I think the one thing that would be a shame is to go too cavalierly and too quickly over this. So we're going to take the next 4 months, 4 months and a week, to explore the relationship between faith and science. For the first 3 weeks, I want to lay out some basic definitions. What do we mean by faith? Another week, what do we mean by science? And then the third week, we're going to look at this idea of the war thesis or the perceived conflict. So what is faith? What is science? What about this issue of conflict? Just going to get that out of the way quickly. Then we're going to take 4 weeks to explore how the relationship between science and faith has evolved from the faith side. How some in the faith community came to believe that science was problematic. This will include a lesson on the nature of revelation. What do we mean when we talk about revelation? We're going to deal with the history of how the faith, how the church has dealt with scientific knowledge, and then deal with the fact that this did change in the modern age, and then the rise of fundamentalism and the literal or factual approach to the Bible. By the way, that is not till the late 1800s and really the early 1900s, but we need to look at that. Then we're going to take 6 weeks just to do hardcore science. Just explore not all aspects of science, but ones that are particularly relevant for our conversation. We're going to do a lesson on geology and deep time. You know, it was the universe created 4004 BC. Where did that idea come from? What do we now know? We're going to deal with Einstein and the post-Newtonian worldview. Einstein turned it upside down. The way we understood the world after him was fundamentally different. We're going to deal with modern cosmology, the Big Bang, and the anthropic principle that the universe seems to be hardwired for life. We're going to deal with quantum physics. We're going to deal with the edge of physics today. This is string theory and LQG, quantum gravity, loop quantum gravity. These are the two current theories in physics about what is actually real behind everything that we see. And then we're going to have a lesson on math and how math gives us insight into reality. Then we're going to end with the issue of post-truth and the denial of science. And this, I'm going to be honest, is going to take us right into politics. So next week, we're going to begin with our 3 weeks of kind of defining some key terms. We're going to start with the faith side of the religion and faith deals.